Chapter 3. Benjamin Hawkins, Agent of Civilization. After all the quote-unquote civilizing work of their missionaries and agents, they remained to the end essentially unchanged, and their hope of survival still rested upon the unyielding tenacity of their native traits. Angie DeBow. Let us start at what some might call the beginning. A beginning before Cow Tom began, because Cow Tom didn't become who he was by accident or happenstance. It is believed that one of the very first encounters between members of what would be the Creek Nation and Africans was through the Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto, who made his way to North America in the 16th century. De Soto came to America long before any rock called Plymouth became famous, and long before the leaders of the 13 colonies decided that those colonies needed to form a nation. But when De Soto came to America, he brought with him Africans, whom he oppressed as slaves. When they arrived in approximately 1530, many Africans fled the expedition and took refuge with indigenous populations and tribes along what today is known as the U.S. part of the Gulf of Mexico. The Coosa tribe, in particular, resided along the banks of what is now the Mississippi coastline. The tribe saw the actions of these Spanish expeditions, killing, pillaging, and raping. And what was clear to the Coosa, who would be part of what became the Creek Nation, was that the black people who accompanied these Spanish explorers were not the danger. No, they could potentially be allies against the Spanish, pushing back against the tyranny the explorers exacted upon the Coosa. And though not all these Africans were slaves, they saw the peaceful life among the Coosa and knew the dangers of life under Spanish explorers. Even if most of the Africans in De Soto's expedition had once been slaves of the Spanish, they did not enter the Coosa tribe as slaves. Reports from De Soto's chronicles show that some slaves took wives in the Coosa. Others were accepted as fugitives from the Spanish and ended up living out the rest of their lives peacefully among the Coosa. Servitude and slavery did exist in the Creek Nation before African slaves made their way to its shores, but this slavery resembled kinship slavery, which also existed in West Africa, where slavery was not hereditary or particularly coercive. Such slaves were not bound to a plantation or an owner. Besides, Creek land was communal, and its harvest was for the public benefit. Instead, slaves or servants, black or not, in the earlier forms of the Creek Nation built homes, tilled land, and minded cattle cooperatively. And to be clear, Creek slaves at this time under kinship slavery were black, white, and Indian, and each of them had the chance to become Creek through adoption and would never bear the stain of slavery thereafter. And once married to a Creek woman, a slave would no longer be considered a slave, and their children would not be the children of slaves or slaves themselves. They would get to be what so few children of color get to be even today, just kids. Once a person was accepted into the family, the markers of ownership faded. Now, this isn't to say that slavery of any kind was or should ever be acceptable. Rather, that the distinctions led to differentiated experiences. In later years, Creeks were so discomfited by the way American plantation owners treated their slaves that historian Claudio Sount recalled that Creeks were afraid their own townships would somehow become contaminated through contact with the oppression they observed there. Gary Zeller wrote, "On the plantations, the Creeks saw African and Indian people bound in iron chains, signifying the ultimate power to coerce, an utterly alien concept to Creek traditions of dispersed authority." As generations unfolded, a group of Black Creeks had themselves, or their ancestors had, worked as slaves for the English, French, and Spanish. These Black Creeks could work as translators, making them invaluable cultural brokers. They often negotiated treaties and agreements on behalf of the Creek, as Cow Tom later did. As more and more white settlers made their way to North America, Black Creeks became fixtures in broader Creek life. How did the Creek go from the nation that once repulsed the very notion of slavery to one that embraced it? How did Black people whose ancestry could be traced to early iterations of the Creek Nation nearly 400 years before their expulsion become candidates for having their citizenship nullified? Usually, answers to these questions include long lists of names, consequences of policy decisions, and a collection of random, unexpectedly important events. And yes, in this case, there are also several partial answers. But in the case of the Creeks and the Blacks, the blame can be placed on the concerted effort of civilization and its forefather, Benjamin Hawkins. It was 1805. By now, the Creeks could no longer stand neutral between the French and the British. With first the French out of North America and then the British out of the American colonies, the United States had begun to expand its own government. States started to cede some of their autonomy to this new national government as it strengthened its federal bona fides, including giving control of dealing with Native Americans to the U.S. government, setting in motion a path for one of the most influential and least known leaders in American history. This Wunderkind was unlike his modern contemporaries in that he had no pedigree, no lofty education, and was a member of no political family. Yet he had the ear of the first four presidents of the United States. Born in 1754 to Philemon Hawkins, an officer during the Revolutionary War, Benjamin attended the College of New Jersey, which later became Princeton. When the Revolutionary War broke out in 1775, Hawkins, a polyglot, was dispatched at age 20 as a colonel to serve as General George Washington's interpreter, representing Washington in almost all dealings with the French. After he served in the Continental Army, Hawkins went into politics. By age 30, he had been elected to the North Carolina House of Representatives and served 1 year before North Carolina sent Hawkins to Congress in the 1780s to determine how the disparate states could consolidate power during America's early fits and starts. While there, Hawkins witnessed the earliest drafts of and debates over the U.S. Constitution. His work for North Carolina earned him a spot as a delegate to the State Constitutional Convention in 1789 in Fayetteville, where he and other attendees ratified the U.S. Constitution. And in the same year, without any official party affiliation, Hawkins earned a seat in the U.S. Senate at 35 years old. This overachiever was a year younger than John F. Kennedy when he became a senator, 8 years younger than Barack Obama, and 9 years younger than Cory Booker. His political prowess helped him keep pace with the growing United States. From his birth to the end of his Senate term in 1795, the population of the United States exploded by 83%. Two states, Vermont and Kentucky, were added to the United States. More wars had been fought and won. Trade with Britain had been normalized with the passage of the Jay Treaty. And Hawkins' own state opened the first state university in America, the University of North Carolina. As a senator, Hawkins touched nearly every aspect of these transformational moments during the nation's early history. But Hawkins' most pivotal career ascent was to come. By October 7, 1805, Hawkins had completed his Senate term, returned to the Deep South, and used slaves to build and run a plantation in Georgia. While his elected work might have been over, Hawkins wasn't done with working on behalf of the United States government. That month, Hawkins returned to Washington to report on the work he had been doing. The Augusta Herald depicted him as a hero, noting, "It will afford pleasure to a benevolent mind to know that the efforts of Colonel Hawkins to ameliorate the condition of the savage tribes and to bring them into something like a social state have been greatly successful, and that they are almost daily, though slowly, making advances in civilization." The article's author expanded on the austere order and prosperity Hawkins was destined to bring these quote-unquote savages. The author continued, "The plow and the hoe are now also in very general use among them, and in becoming attached to property and being acquainted with the comforts and advantages of agricultural improvements, they are losing very considerably that predilection for the chase and hunting life which almost universally characterizes savage nations." To the 19th century writer for the Georgia newspaper, There was almost nothing worth keeping about this way of life, hunting and chasing, that would be part of this young country's promising path to progress. No, the habits and happenings of these so-called savages had to change in their estimation, and Benjamin Hawkins was the right man for the job. In fact, there can be little doubt that a foundation is laid for an entire change in the disposition and habits of these tribes, the writer for the Georgia newspaper continued. Hawkins's challenge was clear: to solve the quote-unquote Indian problem on behalf of the United States government. During his time in Congress, Hawkins had negotiated several treaties with the Creek Nation that ate into its territory in places like Georgia, where the Creek held most of the western part of the state. He knew the negotiating tactics of the Creeks and understood the familial structure of their governance. He knew their laws, customs, and traditions at least well enough for General George Washington to appoint him as the federal government's principal agent for the Creeks in 1786. Hawkins' work with the Creeks made him invaluable not just to Washington when Washington became president in 1789, but also to the next three presidents Hawkins would serve: John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. He convinced a busy President Washington to weigh in on negotiating the landmark Treaty of New York, which allowed the Creeks to defend their lands from white prospectors who tried to build homesteads on lands the Creeks had held long before white men made their way to America. How gracious of the U.S. government to allow the Creek to defend the land they always had from prospectors who wanted to lay claim to what wasn't theirs. He also led two other Indian agents in telling the Choctaw Nation what the borders would be between the Choctaw land and U.S. land. Hawkins succeeded because he helped execute the marching orders of white supremacy, minimize the distinction of others into discrete buckets that could never contain the great beauty of their backgrounds, civilized or savage. Put another way, Hawkins made possible a dangerous and inevitable trap, veiled as a choice for the Creek. Either participate in the means of U.S. civilization to dismantle indigenous institutions, customs, and traditions, or reject the U.S. civilization and have their future determined without their input and accept an accelerated destruction of these institutions, customs, and traditions. So it is no surprise that people like Hawkins were deemed successful for carrying the torch of civilization, white European civilization. These so-called successes, especially with the Native American nations to which Hawkins was assigned, were well documented, often by Hawkins himself. From 1796 to 1806, he wrote hundreds of letters. The recipients were some of the biggest power brokers in early American politics, on topics including nearly every business dealing, U.S. tribal interactions, and almost all his personal dealings. He wrote letters to presidents, generals, other Indian agents, leaders of Native American nations, and the tribes within those nations. His diplomatic prowess was unquestioned. But back to the supposed Indian problem. Imagine millions of acres of plush lands near bodies of water with beautiful embankments and gulfs that welcome the warm waters of the Atlantic Ocean. These lands served as the unwelcome yet profitable landing pads for thousands of enslaved Africans who would produce the capital at nearly no cost that would line the landowners' pockets. The paradoxically free blood money bought with black lives built prestigious universities that generally did not welcome the very people who built them, built the White House, built the nation's capital city. The nation that fought valiantly against the tyranny of the British is hobbling through its infancy, trying to figure out what it can be. States like Georgia, Florida, and the Carolinas, and the territories will soon become the states of Alabama and Mississippi, have untold riches that only explorers, pioneers, and adventurers could just barely begin to comprehend or articulate. But this new nation's leaders made deals with the people they still call savages, often to their faces. These people hold that land legally, but these leaders know that they can always change the laws upon which those treaties were made. These people have what you want, and by the rules of white supremacy, the nation's leaders, these white men, believe they have a right to them. They see these alleged savages as working to equally distribute the land and live happy lives, as Pleasant Porter would put it, instead of instilling private ownership, building plantations with slaves, and dividing labor. White Christian missionaries do what Jesus would not do. Instead of loving Native people with an unending reservoir of compassion, they try to change the very characteristics of Creek culture. What do they do to get states to listen to the will of the federal government? They tame and civilize the savages, subject them to the sort of cultural, economic, and political structures government leaders were desperate to execute themselves. And when they had developed their land, they bought it on the cheap and forced Native people off it, in order to build for themselves the shining city on a hill they think America is. That is what they called civilization. For decades, George Washington has been recognized as the most popular president in American history. And why not? He led the Continental Army to an unlikely triumph against the British Army. He accepted the difficult task of leading the newly formed United States as its first president in its consolidation of federal power among the states. He led when most did not want to, and he resisted the usual human urge for unending power by stepping down after two terms. But he, like many politicians of yesteryear, benefits from our country's penchant for forgetting the critical history to instead portray leaders we have grown to revere in the ways we want them to be remembered. But those who were here first, those of us who came later with darker complexions and were made to live lives at the margins because we had to be 3/5 of a person to compromise with Southern slaveholders and their Northern sympathizers, might instead call him what the Iroquois do, Conotocorius, or Town Destroyer. With the ascent of George Washington came the ascent of his protege, Benjamin Hawkins. Like many other white, newly called Americans, Washington and Hawkins saw tribal nations as a problem. With the Spanish and the French both on their way out, and with the British vanquished, the new United States itched to expand. But standing in the way of satisfying that itch were thousands of families who were there before the white men invaded their lands. These families, Indian nations, were the obstacle to white men's claim to the unknown opportunities that lay beyond. So early in Washington's first term, Hawkins came up with a plan to place the nations under the protection of the United States government in hopes of, quote-unquote, civilizing and modernizing their societies. This plan to supposedly improve Native American society was not meant to improve Native Americans for the benefit of Native Americans. It was to teach them to become more white, more American. It meant that the Creek and others would have to shed what made them Creek and accept the traits that would make them American, to become more white than they could be or wanted to be. This idea was championed by Washington and his Secretary of War, Henry Knox. They were eager, even desperate, to open new lands beyond the 13 states, no matter who had been there first. But they needed to prime these so-called savages to prepare them for the profit-motivated reasons of white intrusion. So they civilized them. While the government's publicly stated motive may have been to train Native Americans in the European skills of cultivating land, farming, and developing industries best suited to their connection to the land, its real goal was to instill Western civilization's notion of private ownership in Native populations. By establishing the idea of private lands, and with Native Americans no longer hunting as they once did, the United States could settle, over time, Native peoples on smaller land plots, divide them, and prepare them for the eventual private sales of their lands. Never mind the fact that for centuries, before white men ever arrived, Native American nations, including the Creek, had been cultivating the land and governing themselves peacefully and equitably. They just did so in ways that did not resonate with European conventions. Bartering, exchanging, developing cash crops, and settling the land to ranch communally and with greater intentionality towards sustainability were conventions of many Native Americans. It was here that Benjamin Hawkins rose to the occasion. His relationship with Washington and his prowess as a political leader at the local, state, and federal levels made him the perfect candidate to train Native people in how to live like white settlers. He started with the Creeks. He began by making nice with Creek leaders, attending community meetings, gatherings, and celebrations. Some of his bosses were puzzled by these actions. President Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to Hawkins in 1803, warning him of the severe concerns that he and other leaders had that the interests of Georgians might be more attached to the interests of the Indians than of the United States. To be clear, Hawkins' job, which Jefferson lauded as indefatigable and successful, was, in Jefferson's words, the attainment of peace and lands, and it is essential that our agent acquire the sort of influence over the Indians. He was the go-to for the U.S. government for instilling peace by way of civilizing the savage and crafting a path for the U.S. geographic footprint to grow, even if that print lay on the neck of the Creeks. Hawkins quickly became the most sought-after political leader for businessmen and politicians alike on all matters Creek and their lands. On February 2, 1797, William Panton, the Scottish founder of Panton, Leslie & Company, one of the country's largest trading firms, which had worked in Spanish Florida and owned 19 land grants, on which more than 250 slaves worked, wrote to Hawkins, "In the course of my tour through the Creeks, I find that you have a very extensive commercial intercourse with them, and that probably your present or future prospects may be materially affected by the political state of affairs in Europe. I do not know that I can in any way contribute anything that may be of service to you within my agency, but if you know wherein I can and will do me the favor to call on me, I possess the decision and will prove to you my readiness to assist you." This is the modern equivalent of a Fortune 500 CEO currying the favor of a new Secretary of State as a secretary tries to sort out the issues that will affect the CEO's business interests. Panton had done this before, presenting gifts to the Creek Nation on behalf of the British Crown. His work with the Creeks and other nations had made him wealthy, and his company the largest mercantile company in the southeastern United States. Not only did Hawkins greatly influence the economic and social future of the Creeks, he took a wife who many say was a Creek woman and named two of his children after the Muscogee tribe and Cherokee. American leaders at the time considered him a so-called friend of the Indian. In truth, he was no friend at all. What to some might have seemed like a white man bestowing onto alleged savages tools to update and modernize their way of life was actually Hawkins working to crater the very future of the Creeks, and as a consequence of the black people who also made Creek country home. On March 7th, 1797, Hawkins wrote to Timothy Barnard, a Scottish trader. He lived in the Creek Nation and had married a woman who was Yuchi, a tribe within the Creek Nation, and their son, Timpuchi, would one day run the Yuchi tribe and sit on the Creek National Council. Barnard had recently been appointed Hawkins' interpreter to the Creeks, and Hawkins had a list of directives for him. First, inform the Indians of the fixture of the post on their lands in conformity with the arrangements made with them at Coleraine. The Treaty of Coleraine allowed the United States government to dictate the boundary lines of Creek territory and that large trading posts would sit on Creek land to harvest all the potential benefits of Creek land with no cut for the Creek. Hawkins' first dictate was to remind the Creeks that U.S. economic interests were here to stay. Later in the letter, Hawkins directed Barnard to inform the Indians of the complaint sent in by the governor of this state, Georgia, to the president, and the whole nation ought to be under serious apprehensions for their future tranquility unless a stop can be put to such abominable proceedings on the part of their young men. Creek men had continued to hunt as they always had, the way they knew to live abundantly on the land they knew as their own, which didn't sit well with their white, civilizing peacegivers. Even today, when white families see faces unlike their own doing what they have always done, their future tranquility is jostled and they clutch their metaphorical pearls. Hawkins doubled down on the unjustified fear that white people had and have of those non-white people, savages causing trouble. He wrote, "One thing above all others you are to be particularly attentive to. The Indians are, as you know, beggars, and have not the shadow of gratitude for any favors they receive. Almost everything is lost on them. Their annuity will be punctually paid, but they are not to be suffered to expect to obtain presents of any kind whatever when they visit our posts. They must in future be treated as men and not as spoiled children. Those who are in the Indian Department must expect to live on their salaries and for them to do the business assigned them, and must exhibit in their own conduct at all times examples worthy of imitation to the Indians. I have come to correct abuses and to fix the management of Indian affairs in those who will zealously and steadily execute the orders of the government." In other words, after ravaging their lands, minimizing their territory, and conscripting them into wars they bore no responsibility for, the U.S. government, by way of Hawkins' dictates, expected the indigenous to demonstrate gratitude. They were supposed to pick themselves up by their proverbial bootstraps, even if the bootstraps they once had were stolen to become the bootstraps of their colonial counterparts. In a letter to Simpucci the next day, Hawkins writes again that these spoiled children and unruly young men have done mischief by continuing to live in America as Creek. But in a quip, Hawkins undoes any measure of independence in the Creek leadership by saying, "You and the other chiefs will take measure to govern the nation." Chiefs had become subjects and dispensers of the United States' notions of justice. In other letters, Hawkins tried to convey his sincere wishes for the prosperity of your nation, and he hoped that Tempucci would believe me to be your friend. It was a refrain repeated by the U.S. government just before the hammer fell on any true expression of friendship. But how many friends write to friends of color, indigenous friends, conveying threats? On April 3, 1797, Hawkins wrote to Creek Chief Ifau Tsunagau to deliver a clear threat. First, he told Ifau that he would need to order as many of your young men as you deem necessary to accompany the sergeant to his post, to do what was called a landline run, to mark the ever-decreasing size of the Creek Nation territory. Next, Hawkins made sure the chief understood what kind of man he was dealing with by saying, "You have had an opportunity to see the Supreme Executive of the United States and many of my fellow citizens, and I hope you have formed just conceptions of the power as well as the justice of our government, and that you will, on all occasions, impress on the minds of your countrymen the information you have received on these points, and how necessary it is to your existence as a nation to cultivate a friendly intercourse with us by a strict compliance with the terms of your treaty." Hawkins, the man who came to manage Indian affairs and civilize the Creek, was actually on a mission to undo the Creek and erode the very imprint of Creek life on this country's lands. What did this look like in practice? Creeks were often strong-armed into selling their lands to the U.S. government. With that money, Hawkins then strongly encouraged the Creeks to buy tools for the advancement of their economy: plows, hoes, looms, cotton gins, spinning wheels, machinery, and blacksmith tools. In agriculture, Creek women were indispensable, as they usually ran the farming, planting rice, corn, beans, and squash. However, he also introduced them to producing and cultivating cotton at commercial scale, and he encouraged them to focus their farming efforts to produce cotton. Hawkins and his team also introduced Creek women to spinning and weaving, showing the women a preference for European manufactured cloth materials and the machines to make the materials more efficiently. Hawkins took traditions of finger weaving that had been passed down through generations and replaced them with what some might call efficiency. Even though they could still make cloth by finger-weaving fibers, the Creek began to prefer European-manufactured cloth, which they had been buying since it first became available more than a century earlier. They now had the necessary machinery to make this cloth more efficiently, thus freeing them from having to purchase it. Controversial conservative economist Thomas Sowell once summed up the essential characteristics of any economy. "The most basic question," he said, "is not what is best, but who shall decide what is best." In the case of the Creeks, Hawkins took the opportunity to decide what was best, without questioning whether he or the U.S. government had the right to do so for those who didn't ask for their help. The civilization plan that rocked Creek life further was the effort to intentionally suppress the hunting habits of Creek men. Hawkins and his acolytes taught that hunting was not as economically productive as farming, but the cultural meaning was not nearly as valuable as the material output the Creeks could produce, not just for themselves, but for the rising needs of the growing U.S. population. For the Creeks, hunting epitomized maleness and manhood. Nearly every time Creek land was ceded or coercively sold to the U.S. government, Creeks, especially the men, knew that both their land and their culture, especially hunting, were dwindling fast. Hunting lands were disappearing into the hands of a fast-growing country whose government felt as if its expanding destiny was made manifest. Long before Hawkins came into Creek life, the Creeks were ranching, but ranching communally. There had long been Creek families who owned cattle of some kind. In some cases, this was for ranching. Many families kept cows and hogs to provide food for their families and communities collectively. The nudging of European civilization and settlers directed Creeks to sell their cattle, to buy more guns, cloth, and even African slaves, a practice one cannot find much in Creek country before the Revolutionary War. To make the Creeks accept ranching, the minimization of hunting, the ceding of land, and the formal introduction to enslaving black people, Hawkins and the U.S. government knew that the concept of private property must take hold. They knew that communalism among the Creeks provided strength, but you can divide and conquer a nation more easily with private property if you pit family estate against family estate. With private property, Creek families adopted capitalism, and rough sketches of class division started to emerge. Such civilization sent ripples throughout Creek country and culture that would forever change this land and what it meant to be not white in America. Hawkins was an effective agent. He did his job and secured the trust of four presidents, running the bureaus that administered operations in each of the five tribes. The five tribes, Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole, occupied large swaths of what Angie DeBow called Great Fertile Land in what is now the southeastern United States. Though Hawkins worked more than two centuries ago, his impact on race in America is still being felt today, particularly by people like the Simmons family. Civilization was just a not-so-subtle term for making America white. The enduring legacy of white supremacy is that it creates and calcifies categories, often artificial ones, to divide, conquer, and eventually subjugate. Perhaps Hawkins and his grand vision for the Creek Nation did not intend to create the path for proliferating slavery through the corridors of Creek life, but intent will never matter as much as the impact that actions have. Slavery, especially chattel slavery, the practice of enslaving and owning human beings and their offspring as property, able to be bought, sold, and forced to work without wages, is distinguished from other systems of forced, unpaid, or low-wage labor, also considered to be slavery, in the land of the Creek, was something that the U.S. government fostered and encouraged. The Creeks did not want it, and when they eventually adopted slavery, it was because they were being, quote-unquote, civilized, and resisting civilization could come with dangers too great. Imagine your Creek in the late 1700s and early 1800s, and you have been forced to accept the tenets of capitalism and the rugged individualism that comes with it. The people who introduce you to these concepts are growing in number at a rate you likely did not expect when they first appeared and imposed themselves on your land. They tell you that you no longer are communally linked to the people you consider family, and are now a private citizen of a nation you didn't agree to belong to. You are competing against them now, and they tell you that there are people from Africa who have helped to generate massive sums of wealth for white people at no cost, because these people from Africa, by law, aren't fully people and don't have to be paid. Now, wealth is the way to outpace everyone else in a community that's becoming less communal. Slavery, as detestable as Claudio Sant said it was to the Creek, became a means of trying to win in a new world that said winning as an individual, not as a community, a people, a family, was the only way to win. Before Hawkins' racial capitalism took hold among Creeks, they did not see much inherent need to use coerced labor. Subsistence farming and hunting were intrinsically Creek and male. So the use of slave labor did not much matter before the introduction of commercial agriculture that Hawkins and the rest of the U.S. government thought would be important for civilizing the Creeks. Hawkins helped to introduce and encourage this practice even further. According to historian Gary Zeller, chattel slavery did not really exist within the Creek Nation prior to the Revolutionary War. But Hawkins was concerned that Creeks did not know how to properly manage their slave property, while praising Creeks who employed slave labor in commercial agriculture. Hawkins and the Plan for Civilization made America's use of slavery as a tactic of reducing labor costs clear to the Creeks. During the Revolutionary War, the British would present African slaves to the Creeks as gifts when tribes within the Creek Nation cooperated with them. As the United States established its foothold in this new land, slavery became more pervasive in the Creek Nation, but it took several forms. Slavery in some Creek families resembled the sort of chattel slavery one found on plantations of white people. Slavery status became hereditary, with slave quarters built on back lots of large plantations. Other Creek families held slaves, but lived with them at near parity, sharing tasks and frequently dining with them. Some historians have found that many Creek families had a patron-client relationship with their slaves. Slaves would provide for themselves, work the land, and provide a kickback of their earnings to their owners. This patron-client system of slavery allowed Black Creek families to build out long-term generational ties with the Creek Nation. And with patron-client relationships intact, agreements existed between slaves and slaveholders to not sell slaves without first obtaining their permission. With the intentional decline of farming, hunting, deerskin trade, and more, slaves served an ever-growing importance in Creek life. Prior to Hawkins' involvement in their lives, the Creeks excelled at subsistence farming, but did not have the knowledge or experience to transition easily into the commercial agriculture they were being forced into. With the introduction of slaves, Creek slaveholders became more effective at commercial agriculture. The demand for commercial agriculture, pumped by the fuel of civilization, empowered by white supremacy, created indelible divisions between Creek and Black, making those who were Black less Creek than they could be. Hawkins' civilizing made less civil and worthy of civility the Blacks who were also Creek. But Hawkins' impact did not stop at slavery. The danger of civilizing people whose land you want is that eventually you need them to leave so that you can take their land. For the Creeks, removal was not far away. The Plan of Civilization split Creek opinion. There was no mistaking among Creeks that civilization was code for priming their land to be overtaken by the federal government through land acquisition. Some thought this was how Creek life would survive, by accommodating. Others saw American civilization as destruction. Most saw civilization as both. In order to prevent violence against the Creek Nation by the U.S. government, in other words, to survive, the Creeks needed to comply with white civilization. But doing that set Creek life on a slippery slope toward destruction. In 1813, the tense divide between factions erupted in a civil war known as the Creek War, or the Red Stick War. The Red Sticks, an assembly of Creek rebels, sought to tear down every expression of America and the civilization that had infiltrated Creek life. They destroyed tools bought by the coerced sale of Creek lands. They killed cattle that Creek families raised in the way this new country had instructed them to do. But instead of letting the supposedly independent Creek Nation sort out its own issues, the United States got involved. General Andrew Jackson commanded a fleet of 7,000 American troops against the Red Stick Army of 4,000. When Jackson and his army defeated the Creeks in August 1814, he negotiated the signing of the Treaty of Fort Jackson, which forced Creeks to surrender nearly 21 million acres of land in parts of what is now Georgia and Alabama. 21 million acres lost introduced a swift economic implosion and laid the groundwork for what came next. Over the next several years, there was much debate in Congress over whether the federal government should stick with its policy of civilizing away their so-called Indian problem or carve a new path of removing their Indian problem altogether. When Andrew Jackson was elected president in 1828, he pushed for a new approach to the Indian problem, move them west of the Mississippi. In 1830, the passage of the Indian Removal Act made his wishes law. From the Great Smoky Mountain ranges of North Carolina and Tennessee to the Gulf Shores of Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi to the rolling hills of Georgia, the Creeks' land had been vast and communal. Yes, they warred, but they also knew peace and institutionalized both peace and war. Their land was prime in its abundance and fertility, and their expertise at maintaining it and their ability to sustain all that they cultivated seemed endless. The Creek, like the rest of the five tribes, were forced off the great fertile land for white settlers to acquire and transform. But when Jackson moved them west, he did so with the intent that this move would be the last. The agreement reached between the U.S. government and the Creeks was that the land beyond Mississippi was supposed to be the Creeks and no one else's. But treaties with indigenous populations seemed as if they were crafted only to be broken. Along the Trail of Tears, the forced removal of approximately 100,000 Native Americans from the southeast to what became known as Indian Territory was a young black man named Cow Tom. He had been civilized by way of being born black, a putative slave, and now removed, marginalized by his blackness, not just by an identity of slave that his descendants today still rebuff, but by an indigeneity that set him, as DuBois would later write, on a road to disappearance. The invention and civilization of the Creek Nation and their removal forged Cow Tom's identity. His long march west with Chief Yargi would set the stage for a fight against the white supremacy that empowered white men to look at Creek land and think, this is now ours. This is where the story of Cow Tom begins, at the end of a brutal march west with no clear vision of what was to come.